Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, remembering the Christ and the Saint Nicholas in Christmas, and the story of wartime foes who decades later defeat the ghosts of one Christmas past. Christmas just hasn't been the same in recent years. Even with the global economic crisis, it seems everyone is still hard-pressed to get their shopping done in time for the big day. But with all the racing around, we often forget the Christ in Christmas. And how did Santa Claus or good old Saint Nick get into the picture anyway? I put that question to Father Bernard O'Connor of the Pontifical Congregation for Eastern Churches.
For lo, the days are hastening on.
Saint Nicholas was a bishop from the 4th century. He was bishop of a place called Myra, M-Y-R-A, in Lycia, and it's corresponding roughly to present-day Turkey. It's very interesting that this man in Asia Minor, though very devout from his youth, there's very little known about him. We do not have extensive writings. We have references. We have sort of collective recollections. And we have a huge mythology, largely influenced by Germanic and Scandinavian and American interpreters, if you will, and people who wish to commercialize the notion of Santa Claus. There are some similarities, but there are many, many, many dissimilarities.
So Nicholas was a bishop in that area, is that right?
Yes, and that's
he was noted for bringing care packages, wasn't he, to people in his dioceses.
Well, there's a wonderful background here. We know that the church, of course, until Constantine, was not permitted to own property. It was fundamentally on the fringe of society, very often persecuted. After the Edict of Constantine, here in Rome in the early 4th century, it became legal for the church to own property, and she acquired an enormous amount of it. And so, therefore,
of course, it was Constantine himself who legalized Christianity for the Roman Empire.
Exactly. And a consequence of that legalization was the endowment by many generous people of the church in their parishes and dioceses and what have you. And it became the responsibility of the presiding bishop of a diocese to regulate charity and to respond to the poor in terms of the economically destitute, but also the sick and the elderly. And now, in terms of, let's imagine, a woman who did not have a dowry for marriage. She couldn't marry. What would she be reduced to without a husband at that time in history? She was forced into prostitution. Now, here we have a very sympathetic bishop, a bishop with a great deal of compassion, a bishop who yearned for the fulfillment in every level of life of the people entrusted to his pastoral care. And there's a wonderful story of at least three women who were caught in that predicament. And St. Nicholas, understanding the implications and what would devolve upon them, arranged for them to receive gold for their dowries. And the story has it that the money was put in shoes, or money was put by a hearth. We don't know exactly which is historically correct. But in any event, money was given to these young women to save them, as it were, from a life of tragedy. And this is why in the St. Nicholas cum Santa Claus legends, you see him always associated with gift-giving. And he was, in a sense, ransoming them for their own human dignity and for their dignity as Christian people.
There's so many names for St. Nicholas: Santa Claus, Father Christmas. But how can we still be good Catholics and celebrate the birth of Jesus while receiving presents from a figure called Santa Claus?
Oh, I think this is a very important question, and it's one that's been asked since at least early in the 19th century. again, the association of legend and fact. There was a Saint Nicholas, a figure known for wonderful expressions of charity, a figure sensitive to the poor, a figure sensitive to the needs of children. So all of that is perfectly correct. Now, where the Santa Claus comes in is when legend takes over. And there is a Christianization, so to speak, of some of the figures of Scandinavian and of Germanic history. You see Nicholas being identified with Odin. You see a whole variety of figures from mythologies of these countries, these areas, that are literally baptized by Christian thinkers. So as a result, we then see the secular society injecting its awareness and its needs and its experience, and poor Nicholas becomes unfortunately transformed. He's Kris Kringle. He is Father Christmas. Yes, exactly correct. Santa Claus, perhaps, is a corruption of Santa Nicholas, Saint Nicholas. So you can kind of see the connection there. But when we associate him with helpers, elves in some tradition, when we associate him with the Yule log and all of the greenery of Christmas, when we associate him with a red costume and a beard, we're actually delving into several of the major legends associating with this figure that converge and produce the whom we know as Santa. A man called Thomas Nast in 1863 in Harper's basically gave us today's version of Santa Claus. Well, what does the Christian do with this? Certainly from Nast's day on, many Christians resisted it and said, this is not how we celebrate the birth of Christ. Well, my honest opinion is that we cannot dismiss poor Santa. He's here to stay. Certainly commercial interests and media interests are going to guarantee that. But could we teach our children that the spirit of Saint Nicholas, whom some call Santa Claus, continues to abound in the world? Might I tell children that it's the spirit of that same generosity and that same charity and love for neighbor that motivated the original Santa Claus that now allows us to want to give gifts to each other in memory of his spirit, the spirit of Christ. So I'm looking less at a dismissiveness of the contemporary form so much as a modernizing in Christian parlance of what we can see to make Santa a non-competitor.
Oh, holy night, the stars are bright.
What to say then about efforts in today's world to dismiss with Santa Claus, or to prevent a creche, a nativity scene, from being put up in a public space where Jesus and Santa Claus are no longer permitted? Instead of sending a Christmas card saying, best wishes and our prayers with you on this Christmas holiday, it's warm greetings for the holiday season.
We see this recently in the decision of the Oxford City Council in Oxford, England, where it's forbidden to have any reference to anything remotely connected with a Christ Mass concept.
Is it a question of being too politically correct?
Yes, in my honest view, that's exactly the case. Best wishes for this winter season of holidays and messages of that irksome kind I find continually. A holiday tree instead of a Christmas tree. In that whole scenario, Santa's been far more successful. Very few necessarily want to dismiss it because they no longer see the association with Christian charity or with the history of a factual history of a Christian bishop. They see him as the great secular emancipator of the fulfillment of the needs of all people, minus any reference to a higher power beyond himself. So he's likely to stay around. The real tragedy, again politically correct, is that there is no place anymore for the holy in terms of public observances. We are so de-Christianized as a society that it is now necessary to take Christ out of Christmas. And we would rather snowflakes and beautiful pastoral-looking scenes than the reality of a divinity born in a manger. And I think there is the tragedy. And it's reflected in court decisions, because some people might find it offensive that we dare to suggest that at the basis of this observance, of this holy day, is more than just a holiday.
It's also something that Pope Benedict and Pope John Paul II have been really calling out for. For example, here in Europe, we've gone so far away from Christianity, Europe's Christian roots, and the two popes have really called us back to remember our very Christian heritage here in Europe. And it's something that not only Christian leaders are calling for, but even Muslim leaders and Jewish leaders are saying, hey, wake up, Europe. You need to look at your Christian heritage. You need to be proud of your Christian roots.
I think that one of the great benefits to be derived from both popes' emphasis upon interreligious dialogue is exactly that point. It doesn't mean that we dialogue in a way to eliminate each other's distinctions and unique differences, but rather to say what is ennobling and enriching in your tradition must be safeguarded and preserved, because if you become weak, and if you become disillusioned, and if you become heedless, it impacts negatively every single person who professes belief in God, Jewish and Islamic included, of course. So we're in this together, we might say. The greatest enemy of religion is not co-religionists of other groups or denominations or whatever. The greatest enemy of religion is secularism.
And consumerism.
And consumerism, by the way, stems from secularism to a great extent. What did we learn in recent weeks? We have learned that if you are converted to Christ, you'll want to divest yourself, not to amass more, but to give more. And the spirit of charity, being Christian, is directly counter to the spirit of consumerism, which says what's in it for me, instead of what is in it from me.
A Christmas wish, a Christmas gift for us, Father.
Oh, what a wonderful, wonderful thought. I can't imagine one better than the message of the angels to the shepherds. Glory to God in the highest, and peace to his people, men and women of goodwill. This is the message, because if we maintain that God is deserving of glory and that our whole existence is to glorify and praise him, we will embrace one another in hope, we will bless one another in peace, and we will be symbols of one another of what love can do to transform what is worst in the world to what is absolutely best in the world.
And a very warm thanks there again to Father Bernard O'Connor of the Pontifical Congregation for Eastern Churches.
Still through the cloven skies they come with peaceful.
It was the Stalingrad of Italy, one of the most brutal battles fought in World War II. During Christmas week 1943, the quaint little Italian hill town of Ortona, overlooking the Adriatic Sea, became the bloody battlefield for German and Canadian troops. Hundreds were never to go home. Ted Griffith was one of the few Canadian soldiers to live to tell the story.
The Canadian Army had many battles in Italy, and some of them were much larger than Ortona, but nothing was quite as vicious as Ortona, for the simple reason that Hitler had ordered the Germans to hold the town.
With his gray-white goatee and plump rosy cheeks, Ted looks more like a jovial Burl Ives come Jack Frost than a survivor of one of World War II's fiercest skirmishes. 1,400 of his Canadian comrades weren't so lucky. They're buried in a well-loved and cared-for cemetery on the Ortona hillside. Just as many, if not more, Germans perished in the streets of Ortona, too. Ted was a tank commander as the Loyal Edmonton Regiment and Seaforth Highlanders joined forces with the Three Rivers Regiment when the most bitter combat broke out between December 20th and December 27th, 1943. What makes his story so compelling is the fact that decades later, Canadian and German veterans of the Ortona Battle were to meet, hug, and cry together, and most importantly, forgive each other in a reunion of reconciliation. As fate would have it, the Catholic chaplain who helped make that memorable event come about never lived to see the day. But let's go back to the beginning of Ted's story, Ortona, Christmas week, 1943.
It had no tactical significance at all as far as the battle was concerned. But as I say, it just grew in intensity because Hitler had ordered the Germans to hold it.
Now, it's been called by many people the Stalingrad of Italy. There was fighting house to house. The houses were booby-trapped. I mean, it must have been a horrific, horrific experience, not just for you soldiers fighting it, but for the civilians themselves.
Yes. The civilians, some had moved out to the countryside. Some of them had moved down into the railway tunnel that was down below the town. But there were quite a number who chose to remain in their homes. And the sad part of it is that the civilian casualties were just as heavy as the military ones. At the moment, the Canadian cemetery at Ortona has 1,375 graves there. The Germans lost more than we did. And the civilians, I believe their losses were approaching 500. You know, for a small town, that is a significant number.
Now, for you as a soldier, it was Christmas time back then. You presumably were very young. I imagine that many of the Canadian, the Allied troops were very young. What was going through your mind? It was your first, probably your first real military experience, too. Did you ever say to yourself, what am I doing here?
We ask that question every day. You know, the significance of Christmas didn't really dawn on us until Christmas Eve, when we had a small dinner in a partially destroyed church. At that time, one of the soldiers got up and played the organ, and we sang a Christmas carol. That was our first sort of conscious thought that it was Christmas. The very next morning is one that I don't care to remember, but I cannot forget it.
Christmas Day.
Christmas Day. The first chore I had that morning was we were fighting in a small piazza on the north side of town, and the Germans had a machine gun set up near the altar in one church, and the machine gun caught the infantry as they moved across the square, and consequently I had to blow in the front of this church. The infantry then went in and took out the Germans that were left. But that was just the beginning of Christmas morning. There was a hospital next door to it, and they had moved all the patients down into the basement. And the Germans had barricaded the hospital, and they had machine guns set up in there. And in the end, I had to destroy the church, or the hospital, as well as the church. And that was my Christmas morning.
What happened to all of those patients in
the basement? The patients were, strangely enough, they all survived. None of them were hurt. They were all in the basement of the hospital. Later in the afternoon, as we gradually cleared the Germans from the square, the line of civilians came out of the hospital, headed by the priest and a little 7-year-old boy behind him, and a number of civilians. They had been all down in the basement of the hospital. And when we went back for our dinner of reconciliation with the Germans in 1998, Angela Arnone brought over a middle-aged man, and she introduced him as the 7-year-old boy who was behind the priest. And of course, he was quite emotional at that point in time when he found out who I was.
But this was the Italian priest of the village.
Yes.
I understand that you had a chaplain with the Canadian troops.
Yes.
And that he actually tried to keep your morale up and
he did indeed.
In very, very difficult situations.
Father Joseph Wilhelm, who later became the Archbishop of Kingston.
In Canada.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right. Mm-hmm. When we... The renewed interest in Ortona stems from Father Wilhelm. At a regimental reunion some years ago, we were all sitting around, as old soldiers do, fighting the battles all over again, and all of a sudden the padre said, wouldn't it be a nice idea to go back to Ortona and on Christmas Eve have dinner in the same church that we had Christmas dinner in 1943? And everyone thought it was a great idea, but nothing was done about it. Wasn't until 1998, and sadly the padre had just died at that point in time. We got into the talking about Ortona, and we decided to go see what we could do about getting back there. We came back, and we invited the Germans that we had fought against.
Was that also an idea?
That was the padre's idea.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was the dinner of reconciliation. And the Germans arrived down, and... we did have Christmas dinner in this church, Christmas Eve dinner, I should say, in the church that we ate in 1943. And we spent a week together with the Germans. Since that time, there has been a great interplay between the veterans of the Germans and ourselves, with messages and telephone calls and faxes and so forth. And... when I came down to Ortona for the opening of the museum, the Germans came down again as well. So,
what that must have been a very emotional moment for you and
it
your,
was
your
indeed
colleagues.
For all of us.
Especially that Christmas dinner in the church.
That's right.
What did you feel? You were face to face with the men who were holding up guns and tank barrels at you in the Ortona War. What was going through your mind?
Frankly, we took them for what they were, which was soldiers fighting for their country, forgetting the iniquities of the German system at that time. These people were good, clean, fair fighters. They were none of the SS groups that were pretty nasty in all, but this group of Germans from the parachute division were the elite, and they were extremely capable. They fought very hard, and they fought fairly. And there was none of this business of shooting prisoners and so forth that you found with the SS. We found that meeting these people, I think, is best exemplified by Karl Barlein, who was a pioneer, an engineer with the parachute division. He was the man who set the charge and blew the house in which 27 men from the Loyal Edmonton Regiment were killed. And in 1998, at this reconciliation dinner, Barlein said to me, "Sir, I had to come. I had to come and face the men from the Loyal Edmonton Regiment." He said, "I have carried this around all my life." And he said, "I have to face them," which he did. And I'm very pleased to say the people from the Loyal Edmonton Regiment accepted him for what he was, a professional soldier.
Was there any talk of forgiveness at that time?
Yes, there was. It was the dispelling of ghosts of Ortona. We found that the Germans carried as many ghosts around as we did. And we fell together, as I say, two groups of soldiers recognizing the professional competence of each other, which was extremely emotional. And the tears were flowing down the cheeks of the veterans, both on the German side and our side.
Killing must be something I can't even imagine what one must experience.
Yes, it's
pointing a gun at someone else and then seeing that person fall in front of you.
It's a very nasty business. But the sad part of it is, in war, you become desensitized because every day is the same. The sight of bodies is always present on a battlefield.
You said that both you and your comrades and the German soldiers, for all these years, have been carrying around ghosts.
That's right.
How did that experience, you were also in another war, in the Korean War, how did those experiences change you, do you think?
Well, one ghost that I have carried around, I never thought that I could ever speak of it, and it wasn't really until we got together and started comparing experiences. I was detailed one night, on Christmas Eve night, actually, after this dinner, to go up and talk with the infantry platoon commander that I would be supporting in the morning. I went up this dark street, and I didn't have the faintest idea where I was. I was looking for him, but I didn't see him. And just by a corner, I stopped trying to orient myself, and I heard some footsteps. And I didn't know where I was for sure. I didn't want to pull my revolver, so I took a commando knife, which I carried. And as this figure approaching came around the corner, I saw the anodized belt buckle that he had, which showed he was a German. I leaned forward very quickly with the knife and gutted him like a fish. And he never uttered a sound, and he fell down against the wall. And I remembered that for the next two or three days, I passed the body a number of times as we moved forward, back and forth. And one day, out of curiosity, I stopped and went through his pockets. And I got his paybook, which showed he hadn't quite reached his 17th birthday. Now that is a ghost I've carried for many, many years. And as I say, it's only been since 1998 reconciling with the Germans and talking things over with our lads who went through the same thing that I've ever been able to bring this out. I've always carted it around.
How many other war veterans from World War II, or any other war for that matter, have been carting their ghosts around with them for years? Perhaps old enemies should consider reconciliation. A pretty darn good ghostbuster, if you ask me. And my thanks again to Ted Griffith, Canadian tank commander in the Ortona battle. I'm Tracy McClure. Laudator Jesus Christus.